Oh, yeah, the other thing I want to explain is that I'm going to do the introduction live on Monday. So I'll just start with the first question, but you can assume that I've given an introduction that tells a little bit about your past, about your current acting career, about the book and the movie. I mean, it's not going to be a treatise or anything, a couple of paragraphs, some of that.
Okay.
Okay. We rolling? Had you heard stories about Americans being arrested for carrying marijuana or hashish before you were busted in Turkey?
Some, not too many. Again, this was 1970 when I was busted. Since then, and I guess with my case, a lot of notoriety and publicity came about. They began this Hassle of Your Life campaign, which the U.S. government put out to inform people of the fact that you can get arrested and spend a lot of years in prison for something you may not even think is a crime. Whether you think it's right or wrong has nothing to do with it. But the criminality of the fact is now being emphasized a lot. But at the time, I wasn't too aware of it. I knew of it, but of course I knew that I would never get arrested because I was just much too smart.
Can you describe the circumstances of your arrest?
Which shows just how stupid I was. Yes, I was at the Istanbul airport with 2 kilos of hash taped to my body and attempted to get on a Pan Am jet to New York. What they were doing, this was October 1970, the PLO had just hijacked and blown up the first of the jets out in the desert. It was the very beginning of all of the terrorism that led to airport controls and body searches and the machines that now are so common at airports. But prior to that, people were never searched going on an airplane. So I was at the airport. What they had in Turkey, they don't have sophisticated equipment. They just were body searching people. But they weren't doing it at customs itself. It was out by the plane. So they took all the passengers through customs, and then we got on a bus and went out to the airplane. I really wasn't sure why we were on the bus, but I didn't care because I'd gone through customs, and I knew, well, I've made it, and I'm just as smart as I thought I was. And then suddenly the bus stopped, and they were searching people right at the plane. And there was no place to go.
So you knew that that was it?
Well, I tried to, again, wangle my way around. They had tables set up right in front of the boarding ramp to the plane, police on both sides, and they were lining the men and women up, and you were filing past the table being searched. And I tried to slide around the outside of the search area, you know, putting books back into my shoulder bag as if I'd just been searched. And I literally had 1 foot up in the air about to step on the boarding ramp when this hand came down on my shoulder. And it was one of the policemen. He said, did someone search you? And in Turkish, of course, I didn't understand, but I knew that's what he was asking me. And I said, yeah, the guy back here did. And he was tempted to just take my word for it and let me go, but the guy back there, just at that moment, fate, karma, call it what you like, the other guy turned around and this guy nodded. He said, you search him? And he looked at me and said, no, I didn't search him. So this guy took me aside and began the search. He went up and down my body and frisking me. He didn't feel anything at first, but then he came up and patted underneath my arms, and I had these hard plaques of hash taped together under there. The reaction in his eyes was like, he was startled, and he looked at me, and I was trying to be very cool, but I was probably freaking out at the time. My heartbeat was pumping 100 times a minute. What he thought it was bombs, because that's the reason they were out there. They were not looking for hash smugglers. They were looking for terrorists and bombs. And I think he thought I was a bomber and that I had this stuff taped on. He could feel these hard plaques or something. And so he freaked out. He jumped back and pulled his gun out, and all the soldiers put their rifles down. I threw my arms up in the air, and I thought I was going to be shot. It was rather freaky. They slowly worked and slowly pulled up my sweater with the gun in my stomach, trembling. He lifted the sweater up with one hand, and the realization came upon him that it's hash. It's hashish. It's not nitroglycerin or dynamite. So he was very relieved and ecstatic, as all were the soldiers. I, of course, was not so relieved because suddenly I'm busted.
Why is the penalty for taking hash out of Turkey, where so much of it is consumed, so harsh? I mean, how many years did you end up being sentenced with?
Originally, I had a 4-year sentence, which just prior to being released, it was changed to 30. Actually, it was changed to life, and it was reduced to 30 years by the judge. They have very, very harsh penalties. It's rather hypocritical, I feel, because the penalties really aren't imposed. They're on the books as being very strict, but they don't make any differentiation between different drugs. And, I mean, there certainly is a difference between marijuana hash and heroin. In fact, all the difference in the world, I personally feel, but on their legal system, it's the same. In fact, you get less for opium, for heroin in some cases, than you do for hash. What they ended up doing was they had a lot of pressure from the United States government. This is the early 70s while I was inside. To crack down on the drug trade. Nixon was putting pressure on the Turkish government to stop the opium poppies from growing, which was then being brought into this country eventually as heroin. And they had a lot of pressure from the U.S. government. $100 or something million was appropriated to be sent to the Turkish farmers who supposedly were not going to grow their opium crop anymore, and this is a staple of their life. Supposedly it was being subsidized. The U.S. government would subsidize them not growing it. How much of that money actually reached the Turkish farmers is very questionable. The fact is they did not stop growing it. They continued to grow it. In fact, this was documented in an article done by a gentleman from a newspaper on Long Island, which is my home, Newsday. He did a Pulitzer Prize-winning article called The Heroin Trail about this very thing. And it created quite a ruckus in Turkey, too. The article came out. The reporter said, you know, you can bribe your way out of any sentence in Turkey, that their laws are hypocritical, that people really don't get arrested and sentenced according to what the laws should be. This caused quite a stir in Turkey as well as in the States. It was at the very time that my sentence was, for some reason, which we never have ascertained, changed from the original sentence to the much harsher sentence, which was on the books in Turkey, but nobody had been getting it. And they said, fine, you want to see us impose our laws strictly? Well, we'll do it. And they did. The people who bore the brunt of it were fools like me, who were smuggling hash, or other Americans traveling through the country, or other foreigners. The big hash smugglers, the big dealers, the big Turk gangsters who were involved were not the recipients of this heavy penalty. It was foreigners mostly. So I think there's a big hypocrisy there in their law.
So part of the reason why the Turkish government was being so strict in their enforcement of drug smuggling laws was the American government's pressure on
them. It was
them.
International pressure, yes.
What kind of help did you get from the American government through your efforts and your parents' efforts?
Well, one of the things is there's not really much the American government can do when you're arrested overseas because you are subject to the laws of whatever country you're in. You can question them and like them or not like them, but they're the laws that you have to deal with. And there's very little the government can do even if they want to help. And in my case, you know, they weren't desperate to help me. I was smuggling hash. That's what I was doing. So they weren't, you know, rushing to bring me back. It's not as if there was some kind of international incident where innocents were taken down. I was not innocent. I was guilty of what they said. I don't think the crime merited the punishment of 30 years in jail, but that's another story. But they helped out as much as they could. They come out and provide translators for you. The American Consul comes out to visit. They try and help you deal with all of the tangled legal work of being arrested in another country. You don't speak the language. You don't know the legal system. It's literally totally an inverted legal system to what we're used to here. You do not have the rights. It makes you appreciate the American Constitution. I mean, we take so many things for granted in America because all the stuff that's right we accept as being right and all the wrong stuff we critique. You have to get out of the States to realize how much we have in the way of civil rights and how much really individual freedom we have until you lose it and then you begin to appreciate it. And I appreciated it very quickly in Turkey where I was literally guilty till proven innocent. That's their legal system. And the American Consul helped me deal with this legal system to a degree. Basically what it comes down to is it's a one-on-one. The 5 years I was in jail, there were a lot of different counsels out there, individual people. And some of them did just what they were required to do, you know, a visit so many months, bringing in mail or helping out your parents, whatever. And others took a personal interest and did a lot and were there emotionally as much as they could be. And some of them actually were friends who helped me out, as in doing things that were illegal, smuggling in letters or taking things out that really they shouldn't be doing because they're subject to the law just as much as we are. So it varied. I have fairly good things to say individually about my contacts with the American Consul. There's not much they could do. I wanted them to get me out. I wanted them to do all sorts of things. But it took me quite a few years to realize what I didn't know about the situation.
My guest is Billy Hayes, if you're just joining us. He's an actor now. We'll be discussing his acting career in a few minutes. In 1970, he was arrested in Turkey for smuggling hashish out of the country. And he was arrested, escaped from prison about 5 years later. He wrote an autobiographical account of that called The Midnight Express, which was later made into a movie of the same name. Do you want to describe the conditions in the prison where you spent most of your time?
Well, prison is not supposed to be a nice place, and it's not. It's a very harsh world. The prison I was in the beginning, you're locked up with... What we had was, it's a Turkish country, so most of the prisoners are Turkish, but they separated the foreign prisoners. They put all of the foreign prisoners into a certain separate cell blocks. We were mixed in with the Turkish populace for a while, but there were a lot of incidents and stabbings and such, and eventually the foreigners were isolated to their own particular cell block. And there were something like 40 double bunk beds. The first year I was there, we were in individual cells, a small little cell with a hole in the floor in the corner as a toilet. I thought it was terrible. It was just a horrible place to be until, again, not... You don't appreciate things till you lose them, until they moved us out of the individual cell block into a barracks-like setup, which was about 40 bunk beds, double beds. So that's 80 beds. Invariably, there were 90, 100, 120 people inside. So people were sleeping on the floor. People were sleeping on tables under the beds. Very crowded, very chaotic. There's very little order in terms of an American prison, which I've never been in and hopefully never will, I think has much more of a disciplined order. You get up at 7:15, the lights come on, the doors open, you eat from 7:30 to 8 or whatever else. Your whole day is disciplined. In Turkey, they just can't quite get it together enough to do that. So it was a very unstructured existence, which I appreciate and appreciated more than if we were that regimented. So you sort of made your own way, and you found we weren't allowed to work as foreigners. They didn't allow us out into any of the woodworking or metal shops or anything like that. So we had our time on our hands. Basically, you could do what you wanted within the limits of what was available. And so there was a lot of time on your hands, which you had to use. It's what made most people crazy. It's the factor that really can't be appreciated from reading a book or seeing a film. Is time. It's months and years going by. It's looking in the mirror and realizing you've just lost another tooth. I mean, I lost 5 teeth in 5 years. They don't have much dentistry over there. It's realizing after 2 or 3 years that people have gotten married, had kids, and gotten divorced back home, and you're still here. You know, it's your life slipping away. In the morning, the day would start with bread coming in. They'd open up the cell block door about 7, 7:15, 7:30, 8 o'clock, depending. Nothing was on schedule. And they'd bring you in a loaf of bread. Each prisoner got one loaf. If you got down there in time to get your bread, if you didn't, someone would steal it and eat it down very quickly and it would be gone. And then they bring some sort of macaroni type of starchy carbohydrate stuff for lunch and like a lentil or a rice soup in the evening. And that's it for what they gave you. Everything else was sold. The whole prison structure was based upon the bribe. Life depended upon a bribe. To go out to an American consul visit, the guard would come in and bring me my piece of paper saying the American consul is here, but he wouldn't unlock the door to my cell block for me to go out into the corridor until I bribed him. It was just per se. That's the way things worked. Everything worked on a bribe.
How did you get the money to keep bribing?
Well, you're not supposed to have money in jail either, but everyone does. The money was smuggled in various ways. People smuggle money in, and that's... It's not supposed to be, but everybody has money. You need money to buy blankets. You need money to buy food. They provide you with this minimal amount of food and then sell everything else.
Yeah, but there must be a lot of prisoners there who are trying to rob any money that you've gotten smuggled in.
Constantly.
So how do you protect yourself against that?
Any way you can.
Uh-huh. How did you learn how to fend for yourself in general? I mean, you were from a middle-class family in Long Island. You weren't used to having... to prove your worth by showing you were willing to fight if...
I had things so easy in my life. In America, we have things so easy. I should just continue to speak for myself, much less the whole country. But we do. It's such... I mean, this whole society, it's so easy in so many ways. We have our own individual problems to go through, but I really had such an easy life. You know, high school and sports and girls and nothing really was difficult. And if it was difficult... I usually chose not to face it. I'd run from things that were really difficult and somehow get around them. But invariably, they come around and you have to face them again, and they're twice as big. Prison for me was sort of coming up against stuff that I had to face and I couldn't get away from. In a way, it's probably the best thing that ever happened to me. Very strange statement, but it was. One of the things I found was I'm very adaptable. And you need to be, because it's such a different world. And you need to – I found that a lot of strengths that I really wasn't aware of and a whole lot of weaknesses that I really didn't want to acknowledge. So in that way, it was a good experience, because it made me aware of myself. I found out a lot of things about myself. Fighting, I guess I was lucky. The very first night, I had an incident with one of the prison trustees of sorts over a blanket that was stolen or such, and I ended up having a fight with this guy. And I'm not Bruce Lee, but I can handle myself pretty well, and I ended up punching this guy, and he was bleeding from the nose and such. The guards came in and dragged me away and took me down in the cellar and tied my feet up and beat me. Now, that's a very rude awakening to the reality of prison world. And what they were saying to me basically was, I was trying to explain to them as they were dragging me away that this guy hit me first and he grabbed my blanket. They didn't want to hear this. All they know is there's a new guy. He's a smartass. He's fighting. So they're going to teach me this is our world and this is the way things work. I mean, I'm trying to explain to them about right and wrong. They don't want to hear it. But in a way, it was a good thing for me, because right away I established that I'm going to fight. So if anybody wants to fool with me in any way, I'm going to fight them. And that's a good thing to have in prison, is for people to know you'll fight, because they just as soon pick on somebody who won't fight, which a lot of people won't.
So it was worth the beatings on your feet and on your back?
In a way it was, yes, because it established me as someone who will fight for what he wants or believes. And that held me in good stead for the next few years.
How sadistic were the guards there?
Most of the guards were just basic human beings trying to do a job, a very bad job, because they're locked up like we are 12 hours a day. They're on 12-hour shifts, 12 on, 12 off. It's a very poor country, so economically they really didn't have much money, and they're trying to support their families as prison guards. A little power, people will abuse it to whatever degree they can, but the guards basically were just Joe Schmoes trying to do their job. Some of them were very sadistic. The guard portrayed in the book and film as Hamid was he was a brutal sadist who enjoyed his power. He enjoyed, aside from physically inflicting power, pain on people, which he did quite well, he liked walking down the corridor and having people cringe back against the walls and just bow their heads. I mean, literally, you stand there, put your hands at your side, and just sort of lower your head as he walked by. He got off on this. He loved it. So he was portrayed very accurately as a brutal sadist, which is what he was. But most of the guards were just guys trying to get by, doing a real bad job, you know. And they'd have to deal with prisoners all day long. They're in a dangerous environment themselves. And this is why they didn't make much money, but through bribes and such, they would supplement their incomes.
Faced with a sadist like that, what was your strategy? Would you bow your head and make yourself humble in his presence in the hopes that you'd be passed over for the next beating?
It's a two-edged sword, because this guy right away, he was the one that beat me the very first night, so he knew me right away. As an American, you have one advantage in that the guards know that there are going to be people who eventually they will have to answer to if they wreck you too badly, such as American consuls and such. Some other nationalities or Turks themselves really don't have this as a backup. So that helped in a way. But you have to establish yourself with the guards as much as with the other prisoners. And it's a question of, if you come in as one of the heavy gangsters, you're on equal or above terms with the guards, and they treat you as such. The foreign prisoners were considered the bottom of the ladder. You know, prison is it's an inverted hierarchy. The worst, nastiest, rottenest people on the outside are on top of the prison structure. And we, as foreign, mostly in for drugs and such, were on the bottom of it. I guess you establish yourself individually. People get to know you and see how you act and how you handle yourself. And you have to sort of make your claim and make people know who you are, and they'll react to you accordingly. If they can push you around, they will. After a while, you have to, with bribes and such, I got to the point where I had some of the other heavy-duty guards as my friends, meaning you're not allowed to have foreign cigarettes in jail. In fact, in the whole country of Turkey, you're not allowed to have foreign cigarettes. They're illegal, but there is all over on the black market brings them in. So the American consul would bring me like two cartons of Marlboros from the PX. I started smoking in jail, which I had never done in my life, and stopped in jail too, thankfully. But the consul would bring me in two cartons of cigarettes, which I know are illegal, which aren't allowed. But I would tell him this, and I also would tell him, when you come in, there'll be one of the head guards named Rajeb, for example, or something, will be there. Ask for him and tell him you've got these cigarettes and you realize they're illegal, so you can't bring them in, but would he like to have them since you've already gotten them? So now Rajeb takes two cartons of cigarettes. An hour after my visit, he'll come around to the cell block and give me one carton. So now he's got a whole carton of cigarettes and I've got a carton. So he's happy. Every time the consul came, he'd get a carton of cigarettes. So this guy is now my friend, in big quotes. So if there's a control in the cell block and they find a knife or a gun or a piece of hash or something on the floor between my bunk and your bunk, and I've been giving him cigarettes and you haven't, guess whose hash it is? It's yours. So you balance it like this. Hamid would never be my friend. And he, throughout the course of my prison stay, this guy hated me. But he really couldn't just walk up and beat me. A lot of it is face. So if you stand in front of him and glare at him, he'll hit you. But if you just stand there and hold your ground, and you can establish that, that's good. Otherwise, you have to cringe against the walls. And I don't like cringing, but I also don't like getting beaten. It's a very fine line you have to establish, and it's sometimes hard to keep the line.
Yeah. My guest is Billy Hayes, and we're discussing his experiences between 1970 and 75 when he was imprisoned in Turkey for trying to smuggle out hash through the airport. He wrote about this experience in his book Midnight Express, which was also made into a movie by the same name. He's an actor now. We'll be discussing his acting career in a little while. You mentioned that endless time stretching in front of you, which isn't structured. There's nothing to do. What did you do with that time? Did you find anything to do yourself that
you
was
have
valuable?
You do a lot of reading. They allow books and stuff inside.
It's probably more black market stuff, right?
Yeah, well, the books come in and they get stacked up and stacked up, and invariably there are a lot of controls where the guards come in and tear the cell block apart, regular basis, looking for contraband. And they would hate to have the books around because it's a good place to hide things in the back of books and the bindings and such. So they'd come in and take all the books out and supposedly throw them away or something. But in actuality, we found that they take them down to the bazaar and sell them cheaply down there. And then all these American books would be for sale in the bazaar. But you read a lot. I got a very structured existence. I began to I'd be getting up about 5 or 5:30 every morning once I got into the flow of things a little bit. And I was doing Hatha Yoga, which was a lifesaver, literally, for me. I'd started doing it a few years before I was arrested. And I'd spend an hour, hour and a half just quietly, because the prison wakes up about 7 o'clock, 7:30. And I'd really savor the quiet hours of the morning to do my yoga and to do some meditation and to try and get centered and balanced for what was about to happen, which is this chaotic day, because it's so crazy inside and it's so noisy and there's so many people. It's a little pressure cooker of nationalities, of religions, and everybody has got their problems, and everybody emotionally is right on edge, and there are so much drugs in jail of all sorts that people were so imbalanced that once the day started, radios would go on in 10 different languages. People would be playing Arabic music and German music and Turkish music and American. It made me crazy, the noise and the chaos. So I really liked the morning hours. I'd get up very early just to have that quiet time. And then your breakfast would come, you know, the bread, and you'd make whatever food you have, and then go about your day. The big event of the day would be mail coming in the evening. People would wait around for the mail to come in, some kind of contact with the outside world. Or if you were going to court, you'd get dressed and you go in the prison car and they take you into town and you'd do court and come back. I went to court about, I think, 14 times, about once a month for the first year and a half before I got my first sentence. I mean, I was in there a year and a half before I was eventually sentenced to a 4-year sentence. The whole time I was thinking I might get out, I might get bail or something, some ridiculous hope. You always have hope, as far-fetched as it seems. But you have to establish some kind of day. There's a courtyard and a lot of individual cell blocks. It's not like a big James Cagney White Heat movie. It's a lot of little courtyards in between individual cell blocks. And you'd be able to go out in the yard during the day when they'd open the doors. And, of course, from the moment they opened the doors till the moment they'd lock them, I'd be outside in the courtyard. And you walk around the cement yard and you stare at the sky and look at birds and watch your life go by. And it's a very boring, monotonous place, broken up by moments of terror and sheer violence and craziness. It makes for a very bing-bong kind of existence.
When did you say to yourself, I'm going to try to escape because I'll never get out of here?
Well, it took me a while to accept the fact that I was even going to stay in jail. I was arrested in October. I was furious that I wasn't out by Christmas and New Year's because I kept thinking, I'm an American. I mean, I shouldn't be in here. Aside from that, it's me. I'm too smart to be in jail. It took a while to get through that stubbornness that got me arrested to start out with. Once I realized that it could be a while, I was thinking about escape. Everybody does, and it's one of the big topics of conversation in prison. But to escape, you really have to do it. You have to do it like all or nothing because the consequences are horrendous. If you get caught escaping, the guards can beat you literally to death, if not half to death, and they don't have to answer to anyone because you're caught escaping. And you get 2 more years on your sentence, and you lose your good behavior time, which is 1/3 of all sentences is taken off automatically as good behavior time. So if you have 30 years, you only have to spend 20 in there for good behavior. But if you try and escape, you lose that extra. So there's a lot of consequences involved. And all of the escape attempts that I tried really weren't 100% things until the one that worked. And I tried a variety of things. I went to a mental hospital for a while. I wanted to get a crazy report, figuring I could go in there and convince them I was crazy. And there's an article in Turkish law that says if you're certified as being crazy, you can't stay in jail. But if you're that crazy, they also can't let you out on the street, so they keep you in the madhouse. But I thought that would be better. It'd be an easier place to escape from. When I got to the madhouse, I realized how foolish I was in attempting to convince them I was nuts because it was bedlam. It was something from out of a Boris Karloff film. I mean, I couldn't exaggerate the madhouse, how crazy it was. When I spent about, I think, 17 days there the first time, and I left the madhouse and went back to the prison, and it was like going home. That perspective. I didn't appreciate the jail until I was in the mental hospital for 2 weeks. Then I went back to the jail. It was like, oh, what a relief. I'm home again. I've lost the point of the question. What were we talking about?
Oh, when you realize that you're going to have to try to escape. Maybe, yeah.
Well, there was an actual point at that point was when my sentence was changed to 30 years because I had a 4-year sentence. I'd spent 3 years or so in jail. I had 53 days, 54 days I was counting down on my calendar to when I was being released, and my sentence was changed to 30 years, which was the biggest surprise. That was more of a surprise than even getting busted. Because I just knew I was free. I mean, I've done all of this time. The last escape attempt I tried before that wasn't really an attempt. It was a plan attempt, and my friend was coming to help me. And he ended up being he was killed in Germany through a variety of circumstances, most of which had to do with him trying to get me passports and papers and such. And that's so – it so shattered me that I just decided, well, maybe – I just owe this. Maybe this is where I should be. So I gave up trying to escape, and I said I only have a year or so left at that point. But once the sentence was changed, this is the rest of my life. I've been here 3 years now, 3.5 years, and they expect me to be here another 25 or 30. It's not like I couldn't be because I've seen people. There are people around me who have been in here 5, 10, 15 years. At that point, a big switch went on in my head that now I have to get out. It's all or nothing. And it took another very abortive escape attempt where a friend was caught and beaten severely, after which I requested a transfer and got sent to an island. It was a work island, and I was able to escape from the island itself.
Can you tell us how you did that?
It's rather long and complicated, but I was able to steal a rowboat. The island is a work island, and no boats are allowed in our harbor because it's a prison island, but No boats are allowed to dock overnight in the harbor, I should say. A lot of boats come in and out because they bring produce from the mainland, and then we can it and make things out of it. It's a work island. The prison makes money off of the convicts' labor. And the only time boats stay in the harbor at night is when there's a storm at sea that's so rough that they can't go back out, which I noticed once in the storm that there were boats here overnight. So that was the beginning of my plan to get out, which they all have little rowboats tied up behind the boats. And I thought I would be able to swim out because I was a lifeguard. I'm a swimmer and such. Swim out, steal a boat, a little rowboat, row to the mainland, which is about 20 miles away, make my way back around to Istanbul, where I had a friend who he was a fellow prisoner who'd been in a lot of years even before I came and who eventually went free. He'd become a Muslim. He knew Turkish really well. He was working in Istanbul, and he just owed me about some things that happened inside. He owed me a lot, and I knew that I could count on him to help me once I got out. Problem was I got off the island, I rode all night, I made my way back to Istanbul, I got to the hotel where he was supposed to be, and they told me he just left for Afghanistan. So now I have no more plans. That was the end of my plan. So the rest of it was just improv, and I don't know, something was looking out for me because I was so lucky I worked my way from Istanbul to the Greek border and eventually swam this river into Greece. It's a very heavy military zone between Greece and Turkey, and it was a very hairy place to be crossing, but I had no choice. My luck was bad for 5 years, and then it turned around. And when it turned around, it was during the escape time. I was so lucky, I happened to have gotten out during Bayram, which is a big holiday. So while I was out traveling on the roads, everyone was out. It would be like our Christmas season. Everybody's out traveling, which makes it much easier to fit in with the crowd. A lot of little examples like that. I mean, soldiers, at one point I was hiding in this drainage ditch on the Turkish side of the river that I wanted to cross, and these Turkish soldiers walked by above me, closer than I am to you speaking here, singing to each other. They were on patrol duty, but they were just singing this little folk song back and forth, and I was hiding down in this little ditch. If they just looked down, I'd either be dead or I'd still be locked up in prison. So a lot of things like that that just broke my way.
When you finally got back to the United States, you suddenly had a life again, but you had to shape it. You had to figure out what to do with that life, because I'm sure after the initial partying and partaking of foods and entertainment that you'd been deprived of for so long, that you had to figure out what you were going to do with your life. Yeah, what was that life?
What am I going to do? The strange thing is I spent 5 years in this prison isolation, and when I got out, I flew home and a Pan Am jet brought me to Kennedy Airport. I stepped off the plane and there were 100 reporters at the airport. I mean, lights, camera, actions, microphones, questions. It was like, what's it like to be home? I don't know. I've only been here 2 minutes. I haven't been home. I haven't seen my folks. I mean, give me a break. And these questions started, and it was very weird. It was a very strange transition. I expected to come out and just go to some quiet beach somewhere and find some lady who didn't want to do anything but just eat fruit, lay in the sun, make love, and just enjoy my life for a while. And suddenly all of this publicity was happening, and it was like a snowball that started to roll. And I didn't quite know what to make of it. I liked it. I mean, I like people. I like to talk to start out with. I'm a ham. But this was a little weird. I got home on a Friday, and by Monday I was involved with talking to literary agents, and I was going to write a book. Suddenly we had all this publicity. I was a writer at college. It's what I was doing. It's the reason I went out onto the road, to gain experience so I could write. I gained a lot more than I expected. But I'd still be procrastinating now about doing the book. I wanted to get away from jail. But I owed so much money mostly to my father. You know, we had a second mortgage on our family house, and I owed him $25,000, and I have no money. I have no job. I don't have a whole lot of job qualifications. You know, where have you been the last 5 years? In prison. That's not going to get me a lot of work. And I had all these offers, so I ended up writing the book. It was very traumatic because I was getting these terrible dreams. I thought, now I'm free. Once I escaped, I was free, and I didn't have to worry about jail anymore. But, I mean, I had a whole lot of stuff that had just been buried and was still there, right below the surface. And working on the book brought it all up again. Therapeutically, it was the best thing I could have done because it got it out to a great degree. But it was a very troubling time for me, very shaking time, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. All I wanted to do was get out for 5 years, and now I was out. It's weird. It's like I dreamed about being free for 5 years, and after a while, prison became the real world, and the outside was a dream, literally. And then suddenly, I was out, and I was in my dream, and it's like a dream come true. I was walking around in my dream. You dream about it and dream about it and dream about it, and suddenly I'm there. I'm free now. I didn't care what happened. Whatever happened was fine with me. Slowly, suddenly the book took over my life. And the book wasn't even written when I got a call from this Hollywood producer, and now they want to do a movie. I said, a movie? I mean, this is so surreal. A movie? You're kidding. They said, no, here's a ticket. Come out. They flew me out to California on the plane, and first class and the limo picked me up at the airport. I mean, the whole ball of wax. This was so bizarre. I loved it. I didn't quite know what to make of it. But the first 3 years of my life were just almost in turmoil, but a good turmoil as opposed to the stuff in jail. It made me a little crazy, actually. I did talk shows and interviews and went all over the country, and suddenly there's a movie and we have the Cannes Film Festival and they're showing the film, and I felt very exposed and vulnerable. I mean, all sorts of people knew all sorts of things about my life, and I don't even know them. They're strangers, and they know all these intimate details about me. It was very weird. It took me several years. I had to get away from it all and to get some perspective on it and to see who I am and what I wanted. One of the nice things about doing all the talk shows and the publicity stuff, I did a lot of radio TV interviews, but I also did a lot of talks in high schools and colleges, because this is an audience who certainly can gain from my experience, learn from experience, in some cases better somebody else's than your own. And they could appreciate my message during the time was do what you like and know what you're doing. And knowing what you're doing means being aware that a joint, whether you like or dislike grass or marijuana or whatever, a joint in some states is a traffic ticket. A joint, the same joint in other states, is 2 years of prison. So you can go from Philly, where it's probably a $100 traffic ticket for a joint, and drive to Georgia, where you'll get 2 years in jail for the same joint. We're talking about geographical distinctions and legality. And whether you like it or not, you should be aware of it, because you'll find out the hard way. So high schools and colleges were a big audience for me. And I loved talking in high schools and colleges. And that audience response, that live give and take energy, I said, what is this? I really liked it. And it was the beginning of, it was an inkling, it was the beginning of a line that I began to follow, which is acting. So I began to take classes, and slowly over the years began to find out what I don't know about acting, so that I could then find out what it was to do. And in a way, it began to focus and began to take shape for my life as to, I want to affect people. And this is the best way I know to do it at this point. And aside from loving acting and it's fun and magic, it's almost like writing the book in terms of a therapy. It's an outlet for things. And one of the good things about acting is that you have to find out and accept all the different parts of you, including the stuff that you don't let the world see, all those little dark corners that you don't like to admit to yourself, or you certainly don't show people. Most of us show the world just very certain faces or certain colors of our personality, whereby as an actor, you need to be free to touch all of those colors in your emotional rainbow, as it is for a metaphor. And I found there were colors in my emotional rainbow, like bright reds and violence and things, that I didn't like people to know that I've tried to kill people, that I've had these urges, or that I've been terribly afraid, or that I'm needy, or whatever else. And as an actor, I had to accept and embrace those parts of myself. And that's been wonderful, because, you know, how many professions are there where you're forced to be all that you are? Most professions, you have to just show certain areas, because if you work in a bank, it's a nice steady job, you make good money, but you can't show certain parts of you, or they're going to say, this guy's weird, you get fired. As an actor, you have to let all those out, and that's been good for me. I mean, I did a production of Bent, a show that, it's a very powerful play. I knew this character instantly. I had so much of me that I have not been able to touch from jail that I could let out through this character in a safe place. And emotionally, it was so fulfilling. It was so wonderful for me. I love to act. The only problem is making a living at it. It's the most economically and emotionally insecure profession you could find. You have to be nuts to be an actor to start out. I think that's ground rule. Now, it's what I'm going to do the rest of my life. So the problem is supporting my family and making a life out of it. I've had a very nice cushion from the book and the film economically have allowed me to live for the last 7 years, 8 years. But cushions deflate. Now I have to make a living as my own. And I've chosen to do it as an actor, and that's tough.
Does being Billy Hayes, author of the memoir Midnight Express, help you in your acting career?
It's a two-edged sword. It got me into most doors. I mean, I can get in most doors in town because they'll want to, well, let's see who this weirdo is. But people weren't seeing me for who I am. I work as William Hayes. All my SAG after equity cards are all as William Hayes because I made the distinction between Billy Hayes, Midnight Express, and William Hayes, the actor. In fact, I sort of ran from Billy Hayes and Midnight Express and all that stuff. I hadn't done any talk show interviews or things like for about the last 6 years just to get away from it. And I wasn't being seen for who I was now. I mean, people change. You know, this is 1984. I was arrested in 1970. I escaped in 75. It's 9 years later, but people know me as that person back then. And I'm exactly the same, just very different. I mean, we grow and we change. And it's taken a while for people to accept who I am. And it's only the last 2 or 3 years that I've begun to establish myself as an actor. And I guess to convince myself as much as anybody else that this is who I am, this is a volition. Midnight Express and all of that just sort of happened to me. It was like this snowball started rolling. Acting is a volitional, conscious choice that I've made and that I've worked at very hard for the last 6, 7 years now, and I'm proud of the results. And so I feel good about myself. So I'm allowing Billy Hayes Midnight Express to come back in and affect William Hayes the actor in terms of using it, because to get by as an actor you have to use everything you can to make it. Things have happened the last few years that have been real nice. I feel I got married. One of the big differences was meeting my wife, and my wife and an acting teacher I met at the same time, a guy named Eric Morris out in Los Angeles, and I was in a very bad place. I just finished doing all the promotional work for the film. I traveled all over the country, but all over the world, doing talk shows and interviews and such, and it blew me out. I left. I ran from New York, went to California, lived on the beach in this little beach house all by myself. I was living in like a little emotional cave. I just withdrew, and I'm trying to act, but I've got this shield up around me, this emotional shield. I met Eric, and he knew me instantly as a person. He knew how I hid things and why I did them and how we'd be doing some exercises in class, and he'd say, do you realize whenever you talk about your prison experiences or any of the really heavy, deep, troubling stuff that you laugh when you talk about it? I said, that's not true. He said, yes, it is true. As soon as you talk about anything that gets really heavy, you laugh or you make some joke. And I realize he's right. It's a way of not really connecting to it. I'm glib. I make some facile remark. I joke and shrug it off as opposed to really letting it in and feeling it. That was a troubling 6 months to a year was when I first started to work with Eric, because he was cracking this emotional shield that I'd put up. In jail, so many nasty things happen that you just can't deal with them. I couldn't deal with them. I had to just, at first I get so troubled when not only my own problems, but somebody else would be getting taken advantage of. Some new prisoner would come in and people are going to take advantage of them in every way they can. And I'd end up getting in fights just to protect this guy's rights. Well, after a while, I just didn't get touched by stuff. I'd see horrible stuff happening, and I wouldn't let it in because I couldn't deal with it. And this continued when I came out. I mean, I've always been sort of a loner in terms of my life. I only let people in to such a degree, and then I don't let them in further. But I was getting this hardened shell developing around me, and Eric sort of cracked the shell in terms of working as an actor, and at the same time, my wife came into my life, and she's the she's the most stubborn human being I've ever met in my life, which is good for me. And between her and Eric, they kept working on this shell and eventually just cracked it. And thank God they cracked it. And now things flow in and things flow out. And I guess I didn't know how much I needed being married. Is that opening that Wendy's given me, is love, letting it in and letting it out. And that was a big turning point for me. So I feel real stable and secure in myself, and I'm beginning to feel very stable about my acting and secure in it. So the two-edged sword of being Billy Hayes Midnight Express isn't so much two-edged anymore. That's sort of fading, and who I am now is who I am, and that's also part of me. But it's not all of me, which I guess that's what I'm saying. Back then it was all of me and all of my life. Now it's just part of who I am, and that feels good.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the productions you've done recently and have coming up?
I started out doing theater out in L.A. I've done productions of Glass Menagerie, and I've done a lot of original Equity Waiver plays out in L.A. directed a couple of films. My first film role was in Roger Corman. It's now almost a classic
sci-fi, classic,
Battle
yeah.
Beyond the Stars. I played a mutant from outer space. It was wonderful. I had this prosthetic face piece, makeup, 2 hours worth of makeup, big hunch on my back. Great scene. I'm the mutant who blows up the ship. If you ever see Battle Beyond the Stars, you'll watch where John Saxon was playing the head meanie. Throws some mutant off the controls of the stellar converter, and the mutant has messed up the controls and the ship blows up. Well, I'm the mutant who blew up the ship. But I've done a couple of films out in LA, USC Productions, learning my craft type of thing. I came to New York about 2 years ago now for a 10-day visit. A friend was getting married. I ended up staying in New York for 10 months, and eventually Wendy went back out to LA, sold our house, and we've moved back to the city because both of us started working. I've been doing... I did Bent. I've done a couple of other theater productions. I'm working with a theater group now that's over on Theater Row in New York. They have a one street that's got about 10 or 12 different theaters in it. And I've been associated with a group there. I'm going to direct a play there, a prison drama of all things. I've been doing some work on the soaps on All My Children, One Life to Live. In fact, I've been getting bigger roles on that. I'd like more because they pay wonderful money. If I could get to do some soap work, I could then afford to do theater because you do theater not for the money. You do it because you love it, but it doesn't pay anything.
What kind of a character type are you in the soap operas?
What did I do? The most recent thing I did on One Life to Live was the plot line had to do with running around down in Chinatown, and there was a pursuit. The bad guy was after the good girl, and there was a bunch of drunken sailors. And I was one of the drunken sailors and ended up singing. We were singing old high school songs and telling dirty jokes and just getting into the mood of being drunken sailors. And the bad guy ended up jumping over a car and knocking me down, and I took off chasing after him. It's fun kind of stuff. It's not as rewarding as doing a play, but it sure pays well, the soaps.
You mentioned before that after the book and the movie and all the tours, all these people knew intimate details about you.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people know you through the movie, which isn't exactly knowing you because
of the changes.
Because of the changes. Yeah. Would you mind sharing your appraisal of the movie?
The first thing I said to Alan Parker when I saw the film is, I love the movie and I miss the rowboat, which is how I really escaped. They made some very specific – they took my story and used it to make their statement. I'm very happy with their statement. I think it's a very powerful, affecting film. If I'd had my rathers and the power to have done it, I would have made some changes. I don't like some of the things they did. The ending is almost an afterthought in the film. They had me killing this guard, inadvertently pushing him and knocking him. That didn't really happen. That guard was actually shot by a prisoner 8 times one morning. A lot of little things like that. Again, it's their perspective. The filmmakers were looking at the movie and wanting to talk about it. Could have been, it was in Turkey, but it could have been anywhere, Mexico, a lot of countries. It could have been the United States. Prisons are not nice places. They're not supposed to be, but they're also not supposed to be inhumane, and a lot of cases they are. And Alan Parker wanted to make a statement about human courage and fears and weaknesses and strengths and such, so he wasn't interested in the escape aspect of it. But for me, rowing this rowboat from the island was one of the most ecstatic moments of my life. So I missed not having it in the film. I'm the least objective of viewers. The film, what for them was the heaviness, the brutality, and the violence of prison, they did a good job showing that. Emotionally, I say the film is very accurate. The facts have been changed above my own personal story, but emotionally it's very accurate. But physical violence is not the real heavy thing. I mean, you get used to physical violence. You get used to the fact that you're living in this world where people stab each other constantly. And it's not like it's a big event. You could go a whole day or 2 days where nothing happens, and it's almost calm and boring, and then suddenly somebody cuts somebody's throat. I mean, it's terrible, but it happens. But the hard part is time. The hard part is the waiting, and it's the fact that you feel like you're losing your sense of self. I mean, I always thought I was special and I had a destiny and things. And then suddenly I'm locked up in this jail for years and I began to lose faith in myself. I began to feel like I'm a loser. And that's real. That's the hard part. That's the stuff that really bothers your mind. And that's the stuff that you can lose to a point where you'll never regain it again. If I hadn't escaped, I was at the point where I needed to do something to find myself again. And escaping for me, for the media, it's a big event. For me, it was just getting back to even.
Mm-hmm.
It just got me back above water because I've been drowning for 5 years.
Do you think you're like more cynical about people in life than you were?
No, much less cynical about people in life. I was a fool when I was busted. I thought I knew everything. I appreciate things that I never did before to a great degree. And I don't know, I found a reason for being, which sounds very trite when you speak about it over the air, but it's to love. That's the reason why we exist. And however you can put that out and however far you can stretch it, you know, whether you're doing interviews, doing acting, or working for the public works, taking care of the flowers in front of the courthouse, that's your connection to the world.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. It's
Thanks
really
for having
interesting.
Me.